Here we are, guys, North Langley. Welcome to our After Sunday podcast. My name is Corey. I'm our worship pastor. I'm here with Matthew Price, our lead pastor. Got it right this time. And we have a very, very special guest, the one and only Tim McCarthy, who, Tim is our pastor of women's studies. No, that's not right. What is that? Sorry, I totally forget your joke.
This interview is over.
Yeah, exactly. Discipleship and care.
No,
that's right. Tell us what's your title?
I'm the discipleship pastor, Corey. Thanks.
Well, I thought it was discipleship and something. No.
And community life.
Okay. Oh, see, Tim didn't even know that.
That used to be that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's actually not anymore.
Just the guy at the top of the food chain doesn't even know that. All. Okay. Anyways, Tim, it's awesome to have you. And Tim, of course, preached this last Sunday. Those of you that know, we're in this series on Shalom. Following Jesus in an angry, anxious, angry, and polarized world, right?
Nope. Anger comes first, then anxiety.
Right.
Anger,
anxiety, and polarized. Yeah, it's true. Anyways, very timely. Very timely sermon. But before we jump into it, so Tim's going to share some thoughts that he had that we obviously with time wasn't able to get to. But guys, what's new? What's going on in your lives these days? Do you guys watch the Super Bowl? we specifically said we wouldn't talk about the Super Bowl, but so I want to keep us on our toes.
Talk about the Super Bowl.
Okay.
My family went for a walk on Sunday.
Yeah. You said you watched a little bit of it, but
at the end, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
But I didn't care about it at all.
I didn't care either. Anything else? Okay, Matthew. Okay. Not the Super Bowl. So how about?
Well, I want to say I was rooting for Kansas City. Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah.
He's the small guy, right?
Yeah. Well,
Tom Brady has won way too many Super Bowls.
Yes, but
he's been there too many times.
He has perfect teeth. He really does. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Gronkowski, they've been there before. They've done this.
Okay.
They did not need to do it again.
Yeah, I heard. Do you guys watch the Jeep commercial? This the infamous.
Oh, Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen. I haven't watched it, but I saw Relevant Magazine
had
an
article too. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you read it?
I read the article.
I just saw the. Yeah, I haven't seen the. Was it interesting?
Cars, faith, and Bruce.
Yeah,
it's a good combination.
It's a good combination.
It's a different kind of Trinity, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you guys, Matthew? You're still reading Goldfinch.
I am.
Yep, and you're still enjoying it, are you?
I'm halfway through. See, I have like a million books that are just I'm halfway through. Not a million, just a few. Like I'm still in my Van Gogh. Pandemic. It's my pandemic book.
Mm.
2/3 of the way through.
Yeah. When did you start that again?
He's in southern France.
Yeah.
I ordered it on Thursday night, the night Bonnie Henry shut things down.
Huh.
We were in an elder meeting and I went on Amazon.
During
the elder meeting. And I ordered Vincent Van Gogh's a biography. Because I thought this is going to take a while.
Is that back in March?
That was back in March.
Wow.
It's 900 pages. So I've read like 600 pages.
Okay.
Good for you.
Nice. Tim, how about you? Are you reading anything interesting these days?
No.
Nothing? Really? Tim, right. I'm like, you're always reading something. There's not a chance.
Actually, I'm reading Letters and Papers from Prison of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm just slowly making my way through it. So he's just beginning to realize he's probably going to be there for longer than he thought. Because he just thought it was just going to be kind of 2 weeks in and out. And so now he's really starting to reflect on a lot more deep things, and it's very tender actually, because they've included, at least the edition I have, they've included all the letters that he received from his families as well, from family members and friends and everything too. So,
that's like kind of heartbreaking. Yeah, a lot of that stuff. Yeah.
Hey, before we jump into the deep stuff here, I think Corey owes our podcast listeners an apology.
we need to make
a note about our previous episode.
Okay. Yes.
He made the suggestion that the coronavirus that we currently have did not start in a meat market in Wuhan. He actually went as far as to say this on a podcast that is like literally it's saved forever online.
And hundreds of thousands of people have listened to this.
All of our hundreds of thousands of listeners now think that it didn't start. And Corey, do you have anything to say?
I have something to say. It was wrong of me to make such a general statement like that. No. So what happened was this morning, I actually legitimately heard this. I read this. I think it was the New York Times that said that they suspected someone said, an interviewer said, like, this has been rejected as a theory. And then, but then this morning, the Wall Street Journal had this article. I just saw the, I don't pay for it. So I saw the first like paragraph or something of it, but saying that, that actually they think that it, well, maybe it wasn't in that market, but it, it probably did originate from an animal. So I was wrong. I did say, now, if you listen back to the podcast, you'll notice I said, I could be wrong about this.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm just, I'm affirming that last part.
I didn't feel like an apology at all.
Exactly. no. Okay, I'm sorry, but you guys just didn't understand what I was saying. Yeah, yeah. No, I was wrong. Apparently, I was wrong about that. So, yes, my apologies, Matthew. Thank you for bringing that up.
No problem. It's just in a polarized age. We got to get our truth right.
No, you're right. You're so right. Thank you for holding me accountable to that. Okay. That's good. Yeah, appreciate it.
All right, now that we got that out of the way. want to just, yeah, welcome, Tim. Thanks for being a part of this today. And
yeah.
And if you guys were able to hear the sermon, we would encourage you to do so. It was on Acts 27, the journey Paul made. On his way, he's in chains and he's on his way to Rome. But Tim, you picked that passage of scripture to look at what it means for us as Christians to pay attention to our emotions and to not to live with a non-anxious, or to be people who live with a non-anxious presence amidst the storm and the polarized storm that we're walking through. And we look at Paul, how he did it in such a beautiful way on the ship with this crew. So you had a few things you wanted to talk about with us. And do you want to say anything more about Sunday or kind of recap some of it?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, we talked about those, you know, when you think about the storm that we're living in, using Friedman's categories of like reactivity and hurting and blame and quick fixes and leaders who won't do what they're meant to do, right? That and these are some of the dynamics that we've been talking about in terms of our angry and anxious and polarized age, and all of those are symptoms of kind of sustained chaos, right? Sustained disorientation and disequilibrium. People are just sort of knocked over and they're just constantly trying to get their feet under them again, right? And when that happens over time, it just becomes a really stressful situation. And Paul's got this example in the storm of someone who just stands steady, and he's got emotional steadiness, spiritual steadiness, and for some reason it just becomes a magnet to people where they're actually drawn to his leadership and they listen to him, whatever role they had on the boat. And then we talked about those four practices of slow down and pay attention and let go and love deeply as some of the things that help to cultivate the non-anxious presence. So, that was kind of where we were going.
So helpful and very practical. And I just appreciated you just slowing down so that we could pay attention to our emotions. And I think that is such a gift in a polarized age. But you wanted to start today by talking a little bit about the brain.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really like brain science. I think it's just so fascinating because it's so key to kind of so many things. So what got me thinking about it is actually there's one thing that I said in the sermon, and I, you know, even as you say it, you're like, oh, I can hear already the pushback, and I didn't really have time to develop it. But I just said the world doesn't need more people stirring up trouble. The world needs more people who are gathering their neighbors, their friends together, and are leading them to Jesus. And I know, you know, there's a whole tradition in the Bible of prophets, and Jesus had that kind of role too, of actually stirring things up. And from the perspective of the world, it looked like stirring up trouble and causing disruption. And so, you know, I think when we think about some of the issues that are going on in our world, you know, abortion or climate change or, you know, medical assistance in dying or the poverty of the working class or, you know, all kinds of issues where real high stakes are in play. It feels like, well, yes, we should be causing disruption. Like we need to get in there and fight the battle for what's right. Maybe these are things that aren't going to be dislodged unless we declare war on them. Mm-hmm. And I think you see a lot of that spirit in the news and the protests and, you know, all that kind of thing. So that's kind of what got me moving toward thinking, well, is there a reason not to just declare war and everyone to battle stations and everyone put on your armor and we're going at this, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, because it feels like, it's funny when you say that, I'm like, yeah, and it seems like everyone or not everyone, but almost everyone who has that reaction and has the just like, no, like this is wrong. And I need, you know, I would say probably for the most part, they all think that this is worth, like this is actually a big, big deal. And I need to.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not as though, and that which somehow feels like a revelation to me. I don't know why, but you know, it's not as though it's just stirring up trouble. They don't see it that way. It's like, no, I'm like, I'm speaking truth. The truth needs to be spoken.
Yeah, because somebody's dying that shouldn't be dying.
Yes.
Or
yeah,
someone's
yeah.
job is being lost because, and it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm,
and
totally.
Someone's being misrepresented or excluded or, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And if we don't do something now, think of their lives that are going to be ruined.
Totally.
So it does feel like, you know, it feels like this, we're in a storm and someone's got to do something.
Yeah, yeah.
Which intensifies all of our feelings about it, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
So yeah. It's interesting, like even as you say that, I thought of the Chilean miners and they're trapped underground. And you could say the best thing in the world is just to bulldoze down and like try to get them out. But actually, the best thing you could do is to move in a very gentle way.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to like, and as they were kind of trying to find the pocket of air that these guys were buried in, it was actually, you had to actually slow down. You had to take time. You had to move in a certain way, not just do your best to try to get down there. It's just like, it's the slow, cautious approach.
That's a great picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, it's a good picture even for how we approach one another from a brain science perspective, right? Because our brain kind of has, I know it's more complex than this in some ways, but a lot of people talk about the brain kind of having three layers of processing things, right? So you have your neocortex, which is your cognitive processing, and that's the stuff that only humans do. You know, you're wrestling with deep complex issues, you're doing math, you're reading, you're processing information. Is that, you know, important things that we think, oh yeah, that's what it means to be human and different from other animals. And but then we also have the emotional side of our brain, and we share that with all mammals, that, you know, it's that thing that where a mom bonds with her baby when they're nursing, or you know, over those first couple of years of life, where the attachment happens. And that's so essential. And anyone who's adopted a child or has been doing foster care, like, they know the impact of not having that part of your brain develop properly, because it actually impacts even your capacity to learn. Like, children who have struggled to attach struggle more in school environments or these kinds of things, because their brain is working so hard to figure out where they belong that they don't have as much energy to dedicate to thinking about other things and that kind of thing. So, and then there's they call it the reptilian brain, but it's just like the total instinct, you know, it's if you move quickly, the lizard runs away kind of thing, right? And we all have that part of our brain too, that there's this just intense run away kind of feeling, or like put up the dukes and just go at it in a fight. And what they find is that, if you haven't been able to, if you haven't experienced love and you haven't developed that attachment area, or you're not experiencing love and dignity and those kinds of things from the people that you're interacting with, you're just not going to engage the conversation that they're trying to have with you, you know? And I mean, you can think back to your own teenage experience, right? Or teacher or whatever. Like if a parent, and I've done this to my kids before too, right? Where it's like, you are making it so clear and you're raising your voice and you're getting at it, trying to make it clear why they did the wrong thing. And like, they're not getting it. And part of the reason is because you're yelling, you know? And so they're not sensing care. They're sensing threat. And as soon as you sense threat or detachment, your cognitive side, your neocortex is going, sorry, I don't have time for that. How do I survive this without getting hurt or killed or rejected, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we experience that in our very personal situations. But it just reminds me of, you know, when Paul talks about, if I can do all these amazing things, I can talk with the tongues of angels, I can be incredibly persuasive and put all kinds of amazing thoughts together, but I don't have love, I'm like a clanging gong. And brain science would say, technically, that's true. You know, that if you're not experiencing love from someone, it's like those adults in the Charlie Brown. It's just wah, 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 wah. It's not even getting through. And yeah.
Help me, because I know nothing about the brain.
Yeah.
So if the neocortex, you're saying, let's say that's like the kitchen in a house. Yeah. It's where deep conversations are had around the kitchen island, mm-hmm. you know, or something like that, making food, right? It's the deep, we're talking deep stuff, changing our minds about things. You're saying to get to the neocortex, you have to walk through the, you know, the front door, the hallway is the hallway of the emotions. Mm-hmm. That the best way to get to the kitchen is through a hallway of like, love and emotions and feeling loved, like entering a warm home going, this is an okay place. And it's my only way to get to the kitchen where I can actually change my mind on an issue. Is that what you're saying?
And it's not just emotions like, I just didn't feel like it today. It's like that deep, those places where I need to feel accepted, belonging, attached to someone, some sense of covenantal connection, you know, because otherwise it's like you're trying to have a deep conversation, but you haven't invited me in the house, and you're making it conditional that I come in the house, or you know, whatever that kind of thing, and so that happens on a personal level, and it also happens, I think, societally, that the louder we yell, the more belligerent we get, the more kind of at one another we get.
Yeah.
The more everyone just hunkers down into the fighter position and says, I don't care what you're saying, don't swing at me, you know, and we're just, and it makes dialogue really, really impossible. So I think as Christians, we do have a truth to communicate. We do want to get something across that involves getting your, you know, your thinking processes going and you're reflecting, and what does that mean? And why would God want that for me? And, you know, all the deep questions that we want people to wrestle with. But if we don't have love, they're not getting it at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how hard, how loud we yell it, or even how articulately we do it. If we do it in a way that comes across as a threat, then they're that skittish little lizard, or the cat with its back up.
Yeah, you know? It's so tragic. It's beautiful. Like, it's just, but it feels so tragic to me. Like, you just think, like, because so many of us, and you know, not, I'm thankful for being raised in a home where I did feel loved, and I did, you know, but you think, man, so many people have the odds stacked against them in this way, right? And it's so sad. And it seems like it's actually world changing, right? Like, this science feels like if we could all really get this in our guts, because that was a good summary. Like, I like that idea of being like the house where you got to go through the hallway to get to the kitchen. You can't just have, and I for sure have been in that situation where I felt attacked, you know, even whether it's someone close to me, or whether it's like in a situation where it's just a weird, surreal thing where a stranger is acting aggressively. It's like, it's totally true. You get that fight or flight kind of thing, right? Where you're just like, the last thing you're thinking about is the message that is, you know, trying to be communicated. You're just like, I got to survive this. I got to find a way to somehow bring this to an end, whatever this is right now, because this is horrible or this is scary. Yeah.
Totally. And I appreciate this point, Tim, because it makes so much sense. And not me, myself, not understanding the brain, this makes perfect sense, because I think of, in a couple of weeks, I want to use the text of Zacchaeus. Mm-hmm. The only way Zacchaeus can change something in his neocortex is because Jesus has a meal with him, you know, and you just think, like, Jesus knew that the path to Zacchaeus changing was through this invitation to love, to be loved and whatever. And the other thing it made me think of was the show Waco. Hmm. Have you guys seen that show on Netflix? The Waco. Anyway, it's but Branch Davidian.
Waco.
The show. Space. Waco.
You didn't say it like that.
Oh, really?
You said, it made me think of Showeco. Like, what's Showeco?
Showeco, it's an interesting drink. It's a Showeco.
Totally, but I know
the television series, Waco. And the Branch Davidian, where the FBI negotiator is saying the best way to end this conflict is for David Koresh to feel listened to and heard. He's not going to back down mm-hmm. until he knows that I understand him yeah. and that we actually build a bond and a real relationship, not a fake one. Mm-hmm. And the whole time he's trying to do this while the FBI is bringing in their tanks.
Yeah.
Mm. And it's a mixed message. It's like David Koresh doesn't know, wait, are you going to shoot me or do you really mm-hmm. care about me? And they're trying two simultaneous. And I feel like our polarized age, mm-hmm. David Koresh is like, I can't do this with a gun to my mm-hmm. head.
Totally.
Like
I, yep.
But you say you care about me. Anyway, that's what it
means.
Me.
It's really interesting, actually. You mentioned Waco because there's an attachment story around that, too, where the kids that they got, that they rescued from Waco, right? There was a yeah. whole group of kids yeah. that got released and they were taken away. And then for like 6 months, they did nothing with them, nothing. And so really? Within a very short time, the kids organized themselves exactly like they had been organized mm. in the compound. Hmm. Which was, you know, boys over girls and, you know, all these things. And they thought, yay, look, you guys are free. And all they knew was to go back to these structures that they'd known. And which there were lots of reasons why it was wrong. But they just, that's how they had been socialized.
Wow. Hmm.
And it wasn't until someone said, we've got to, like, get in these kids' worlds and
yeah.
find out what's going on and start to show them a different way that, actually changes started to happen, which is really fascinating.
Huh. Yeah.
But that's why therapy takes time, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It, you know, a person can come into an office or a pastor's office or that kind of thing and say, you know, they dump some stuff on the ground and the pastor can go, I could tell you what's wrong right now. Like I can pretty much see it, you know, and yeah. You can name the things you could do differently if, and everything would go well, but that's not where the insight is. The insight is in coming into a person's world and listening to them and them feeling loved, and then light starts to sort of dawn in the darkness of their mm. lives, right? Like yeah. that's how therapy really works. And I think that's a good picture for our world as well, right? Is that, you know, even if we are pretty sure we know the answers to a lot of the problems the world is facing, if we don't inhabit their world in the same way that Jesus did with us, like we're just not going to get through because people yeah. won't receive the insight for themselves.
It's funny. I know we need to move on to the next point, but it's funny mm-hmm. as you say this, I was laughing. Do you guys remember the okay, do you remember that the YouTube video? It was all about like the guy, the girl who has the nail in her head and yeah. the boyfriend is yeah. like saying like, "Well, you've got a nail in your head." And she's like, "I don't need you to fix this." You know, and it's this yeah. whole funny thing because she's yeah. like, "I just have this like aching, throbbing head." And he's like, "Well, yeah, you've got a nail in your head." She's like, "Kate, can you not? Like, I just, you know." And finally at the end he's like, "That must be really hard." And she's like, "Thank you." But it's funny. So to a serious point, yeah. though, I wonder, it actually makes me wonder if, like, even what you're describing, I know this is generalization, we don't like to generalize, but guys often, I have found, I certainly do, I struggle with this very thing because mm-hmm. I want to, like, if Sherry is upset about something or, like, my immediate thing is to fix it. I can mm-hmm. fix it. I know, okay, it's super obvious to me, here's what you got to do, you know, yeah. which any other guys will know this, that's rarely the right way to yeah. go about it, right? Because for her, she needs me to... like you say, enter into her world and actually be like, oh, that does sound, you know, that's mm-hmm. like, oh, that is frustrating. Like, yeah, you know, as opposed to the quick fix. And I wonder if...
Except for the 5% of time that she actually wants it to be fixed. Yeah, exactly. And then you've really missed your chance.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. That's yeah. right. This is a whole other podcast. Yes, exactly. Yeah. We should probably do this at some point. But anyway, it's interesting, yeah. right? You wonder if, like, I wonder if there's something about... like women that just do this better than guys. I don't know. Mm. It's just interesting to say that as you're talking about it, that made me think about that in my own marriage. Yeah.
So Tim, you wanted to bring just some, as a second piece here today, yeah. just some biblical images mm-hmm. of what this looks like.
Yeah. So, you know, when Jesus talks about his people changing the world, you know, this kingdom of disciples that's following him, it's interesting that the images he uses are never battle images, you know. Mm. So he uses that image in Matthew 5 of being salt, in being the salt of the earth. And that salt is, it's tiny, it has one job, but when it is put in the meat, it becomes a preservative, it becomes... And it also it preserves the taste of the meat, but it also protects the meat from disease mm-hmm. and bad things like that. In Luke 13, he uses the image of a mustard seed, which you know, is a very small seed. And yet he says, you know, that you plant that tiny seed in the ground. And it was the mustard plant was actually considered a weed. Like, it wasn't something that a Jewish person wanted in their garden. It was unclean in a sense. But it Jesus uses this image of, like, humble, unclean, whatever. But when you plant it, it becomes a home for birds all over the place. And and this beautiful image of this tiny thing that over time becomes a home for all kinds of people. And then right after that, he uses the image of yeast. That, and of course, yeast is an unclean thing for Jews as well. And he's going, no, but there's a good thing about yeast. This tiny little thing that goes, that's put into the bread, makes its way through the whole dough, so that this tiny little bit of dough makes a bunch of loaves that a bunch of people can enjoy, and hospitality and all those kinds of things. So these are like, they're pictures of ordinary, unremarkable things that still make a huge difference over time, but it always happens patiently. And so it's that image of, like, a few people, one person, a small community of people in a neighborhood or in a workplace or even in a large extended family or in a particular field of work, just a little bit of something planted there doing its slow, patient work becomes something good for the whole culture. So they're really beautiful images in that, in that sense.
How would you, Tim, what do you think the difference is? Because I think some people who might hear that go, oh, I know what that means. It means me in my workplace, I keep telling the truth of the conspiracy theories I've heard and the things that I know are right.
Yeah.
And if I just keep doing it, I'm only one person in my work, slowly like yeast, it'll grow. And you know, like, what's the difference between that and, like, what I think you're getting at is more of a, it's more of an attitude or being faithful to the kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, what does it look like? Because I want to know kind of what that would look like on the ground, in a family, in a workplace.
Yeah. I mean, what comes to mind for me is in Isaiah 8, there's this verse that says, do not call conspiracy what everyone calls conspiracy. It's a great verse. It's so relevant.
I was gonna say.
And the context of it is that people in Judah are talking about all the threats around them, and what that's doing is motivating them to come up with solutions. Let's go ask Assyria for help. Let's go ask this power for help. Let's maybe Egypt can help us out, because, you know, something is bearing down on us in this way or that way, and all these conspiracies are going on. And Isaiah says, like, don't bother yourself with all these conspiracies. What we have to do is head back to the Word of God, head back to the law, head back to the Torah, the teaching. And this faithful remnant of disciples are going to live what God has always taught us, which, of course, the law is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. So it's this picture of, like, faithful discipleship to what God has always taught us about how we live life under His reign. And don't bother yourself with all the conspiracies. That there's nothing good that comes of that. And there's the solutions you'll come up with to fix those conspiracies are different than discipleship, and they'll probably create as much trouble as you gain from them, you know. So I think and that's the image in the New Testament, I think, a lot as well. Like, when there's a battle image, it's a battle against spiritual powers, and the armor we wear is Christian character, you know. So if there's a battle going on, it's a battle against the way the enemy wants to manipulate us in all kinds of ways. The enemy being Satan and the principalities and powers, and our defense against him is, you know, in Romans 13, it's different aspects of Christian character. In Ephesians 6, it's the helmet of salvation and the shield of truth, and, you know, those kinds of things. So I don't know if that...
I think it's helpful, because it says, like, what I hear you say is the character piece, I think of Galatians and the fruit of the Spirit, and you're saying it that mustard seed idea of the kingdom, or the salt, or the, what's your third image?
Yeast.
Salt, yeah, and yeast, is that actually we're living the fruit of the Spirit in those places, and we're actually trusting that God will will, through salt, preserve, right? It's the kingdom, and it's He will do it in us as we're faithful to His character.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love it too. It makes me think, like, of, that's exactly what you're talking about with the brain science. Actually, back to that, it's like courage seems to me that it happens, at least in my life, And we read it, I think we see it biblically as well. When I know and I'm secure in the love of my Father, like if I know that God loves me, when I actually truly know it, and I don't always, I know it in your head, mm-hmm. but like when you fully engage with it and understand it, like I remember reading Henri Nouwen, and he talks about loving our enemies, and we actually have to first love ourselves and mm-hmm. understand how we are loved, actually. Right. And then that actually makes it far easier to love our enemies, because mm-hmm. we suddenly, there's a confidence and there's an assurance in that. And so we don't need to fear, like mm-hmm. even kind of like what Isaiah said, like you don't need to, like, we go back to the Word of God. We go back to, so that idea of being, of understanding our belovedness, mm-hmm. I suppose, in a way, is a start, right? And it's the same idea of like the kitchen, you know, going from the hallway into the kitchen. It's like, yeah. start with the fact that you are beloved, you're a beloved son and daughter mm-hmm. of God. And then we walk into this conversation, Robert. Anyways, that's really cool.
So our final point today, Tim, you wanted to talk about what it means to be a faithful presence. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's related, I think, to what we're talking about already, right? Tim Keller talks about the whole salt image, and I love this. He just says, just as salt can only help the meat if it retains its saltiness, Jesus added, we can only help the world if we retain our integrity. Hmm. And our integrity being the character of the Spirit. And I think a great historical example that I read about in a book by Alan Kreider called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church is the early church. That's the example. And it's this, what he says when you look back on the writings of the early church, and this is like second, third centuries of the church, when they looked at what was going on and they saw the church growing and expanding, and not because they had some aggressive evangelistic strategy or culture-changing strategy, and they reflected on, why are we growing? Like, why do people keep wanting to be part of what we're doing? The virtue that they constantly wrote about was the virtue of patience. Hmm. And he says, there's more writings about patience than any other virtue in those first two centuries. Hmm. He says that it was like a ferment. That's why he uses that image of ferment, right? That's what yeast does in bread. That's what it does in alcohol. It just sort of slowly does its work and goes out into the culture. And these communities were attractive to the world because, not because they went out there saying, we're doing it better than you, but they tried to live with as much integrity as they could within themselves, that the people who were looking at the world that they were experiencing, and there's violence and there's exploitation of people, and you know, there's the games going on in the Colosseum where people are just getting hacked to death, and you know, just all these, and there's Roman people, there's Greek people looking at the culture going, this is gross, you know, and they don't like it, and they start looking around going, well, is there anyone doing something different? They would see the Christians, and so some of the things that he mentions that Christians were doing was like, you know, they weren't manipulating business so that they could get more profit. Just by being dishonest or misusing people. They were faithful, you know, to marital boundaries. They were inclusive of men and women and children within their communities. They were caring for the poor. They weren't taking lives, but preserving lives. They were they weren't into coercion, right? So they weren't going to use violence to make people come around to their side. And they had this spiritual power that if you went to worship with these people, like, it was highly likely someone would get healed or someone would have a demon cast out, and it was just normal. And that was just their life together, their way of life, and the just patiently, steadily doing that. More and more people looked at them and went, I don't like what's going on in the culture, but I like that. That seems like there's life. And not everybody did that. But there was a huge shift, actually, when Christianity became more legal and it became more advantageous. Suddenly there were some people thinking, well, this is great. We can get impatient, and, you know, the violence and the military and government power all comes into it, and lots of problems came out of that. But it's that's just a historical example, I guess, of the mm-hmm. faithful, just faithful, patient presence. Hmm. the difference it makes.
I love that. I love the fermenting idea in the maybe in a way that is more complicated and maybe not always positive, but you think of some of the things that were happening in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. That has been a fermentation of our culture.
Yeah.
Some for really good things like racial equality and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But like the free love movement, right? Like hippies were talking about free love and this whole thing. That's actually been fermenting, mm-hmm. growing in our culture to the point where it feels like politics is like 50 years downstream of culture, mm-hmm. you know, and now those that are, let's say, in Ottawa or in Washington, they were teenagers and many of them are baby boomers, and they were part of the fermenting of this free love movement or whatever. Yeah. And so I'm not trying to throw hippies all under the bus here, but I'm trying to say like, that's an example of maybe it moving in a way that is not great and has led to lots of pain. But that we as a church are called to just continue to be who Christ has asked us to be, and mm-hmm. that there will be a fermenting. And it happened in Rome. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that it may not always happen in my life, but I'm part of a long chain of mm-hmm. people that need to stay faithful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah. It's like, it reminds me of, I was thinking of this when you were talking earlier, a couple things. Like, one is that it feels like, do you think that in our day and age with technology and with the quick fix that we've never had the quick fix like we have it now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, and I love it so much, right? I love that it's like, if I want a song, I get the song within mm-hmm. 30 seconds. I can find the song, you know? It's never like we, you know, as we're all close to the same age, when you're like, you know, it's like, I used to have to wait.
I'm so much younger.
You're at least.
I'm doing this podcast with a couple old men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, back a little short.
I'm the eldest among us.
Yeah, Tim is the eldest by a couple months. Is that mm-hmm. right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But you know what I mean? I feel like it's like, it, in some ways, that has to be working against us with mm-hmm. this, right? The idea that we are used to solving things quickly, to having YouTube, like, you know, like, oh, I got a leaky sink, YouTube, mm-hmm. boom, you know. It's never been like that. And so in some ways, it's like, I wonder if we have this tyranny of the urgent in a way where it's like, we just got to happen now. It's got to happen mm-hmm. now. And I always come back, I just love the title of Eugene Peterson, who took it off of Nietzsche, whatever, like the mm-hmm. A long obedience in the same direction. Yeah. Like, that's mm-hmm. what this sounds like, you know, as opposed yeah. to, and people always want, like, what's the quick fix? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. counseling, it's like, do I have to, like, can I just do one session? Will that be enough? It's like, no, this is like a long haul, right. you know? But anyways, it made me wonder about like technology, yeah. you know, yeah. if that is working against us, at least training our minds
yeah.
and our hearts to have quick solutions to problems, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Well, and if you watch like The Social Dilemma, which we watched this weekend, the documentary, like you get this picture too, that it's not only working against us, but it's exploiting that the quick fix and the quick access and the, we can give you exactly what you want, and we're watching you all the time to give you even more of what you want.
Right.
So it isn't just you can find what you want, but you can go down the rabbit hole of what you want and never come out again, because we'll just keep feeding it to you to profit from it. So there's an exploitation of our desire for something like that too.
Yes.
So
yeah.
And some of the good, the beautiful things, like I think about it with my mother and father-in-law and like their 60 years of marriage, I think that the fruit that has come from their 60 years of faithfulness to each other is incredible. It's beautiful. It's mm-hmm. like you see the ripple effect in all of Tanya's family mm-hmm. and the blessing it's been to multiple generations. Mm-hmm. And I think like in a world of, you know, pornography or instant gratification, it's just we're wired right now not to go the patient, faithful mm-hmm. presence. Yeah. We're wired to go for the quick fix.
It is interesting though that it like it isn't just, well, let's just stay faithful. All of us doing our thing. There is a sense, like there can be a strategy to it. And that's one of the books that I had to read in my studies was by a guy named James Davison Hunter on changing the world. Part of what he talks about is that it isn't just Christians being faithful. That whenever Christians made a big change, and even some of these other big changes like you talk about with sexual ethics or different things like that, the change happened because of a faithful presence in strategic places. So because there were faithful Christian artists. There mm-hmm. were faithful Christian business people. There were faithful, you know, in those in the area where change needed to happen, there were people who said, we're going into that field believing God has something to say about it, and we're going to live that with integrity for yes. the blessing of our of that field and those kinds of things. And
right.
part of his critique is that whether it's right or left or more separatist movements, there's just this mentality of like, he kind of uses like a resentment offense, like constant offense. Mm-hmm. We're yeah. just constantly offended by the right. We're just constantly offended by the left. We're just constantly offended by all of it. Mm-hmm. And we just can't wait for Jesus to come back or whatever, you know, and those, these senses, the sense that like, it's all horrible. And if only someone would take it over and make it right, it would be good. Mm. And you just, you don't even see that in Jesus. He comes down and incarnates in the world. And there's a million things he could call out as broken that he doesn't. And mm-hmm. and he just, he goes into the world with this sense of like looking for things. Like he does call some things out, but Hunter kind of observes that the way that Jesus did it was he was just living out of intimacy with his Father. He never strove to get a position mm-hmm. somewhere. In fact, he avoided it. He always had compassion, and he never coerced people. So if someone didn't want to go with him, he didn't put them in a headlock mm-hmm. and drag them along, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a totally different posture from how these other camps are doing it, where it's like, if we could just finally have enough power to force people into our way.
Yes, right.
Which is just, it's not at all Jesus' way.
Mm-hmm. No, no.
Tim, we've talked about, you and I have talked about this yeah. before, but like, what do you think then is the tension with, like when you say faithful presence, I feel like you could be thinking of a monastic community or like mm-hmm. in our tradition of Mennonites kind of being in yeah. their own communities, pulling away from culture.
Yeah.
But when you talk about salt and being a non-anxious presence, you have yeah. to be there, yeast, some of these things, it speaks to engagement.
Yeah.
So what do you think, like, so putting on the spot here, mm-hmm. in our cultural moment, I think what you're saying is engage, mm-hmm. stay, seek the peace of the city, be a non-anxious presence, whatever. But where's the place where you kind of go, you know, I got to get out of here. And mm-hmm. we need to just pull away and be a city on a hill mm-hmm. a little bit
yeah.
pulled away from culture. How do you navigate that tension mm-hmm. of being in the world, pulling away?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Hunter uses the image of he calls it affirmation and antithesis. So if we believe that God is at work in the culture, and I mean, when you look in the Bible, like God often is talking about himself doing things in godless cultures, you know, Babylon is his instrument, Assyria is his instrument, and he doesn't at all affirm what they're about, but he's also using them, or there's elements of their culture that are reflections of his nature, and then lots of things that aren't, and that kind of thing. I guess that's the problem with that sort of offense taking, is it's always this sense that, well, they're doing everything wrong, we're the good guys. And the humble Christian position is to say, there's a lot of things that are broken in the world, but we can see God at work there and there and there and there. And we're trying to do our best here, but we recognize we still have this and this and this that also need to be like, and it's that, you know, Solzhenitsyn, I can't say his name.
Solzhenitsyn, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Russian guy. You know, the heart of evil goes through the heart of every person, or the line between good and evil is mm-hmm. between the heart of every person. So we can't retreat and think that we're separate from
right.
the world. I guess that's the thing,
yeah.
right? And so when we're trying to cultivate a sense of faithful, non-anxious presence, when we retreat, we're retreating into the presence of God, where we can be convicted of our own sin, where we can be nurtured in the love of God for us, mm-hmm. when we can get a sense of who we are again and what his call is for us. And then that nurtures us to go back out into our space,
yeah,
our spaces in the world, whether that's an extended family where most people aren't Christians, or a workplace that we're part of, or a whole field of work that we happen to have influence in, whether we're in the arts or we're in construction or architecture or finance or whatever it might be, entertainment. And we go there having been nurtured in a community of people that are making Christ their Lord.
Yeah.
That we faithfully, with integrity, incarnate that Christian character, which is it's very practical. It's like, how do you pay your workers? What do you include in this, your storytelling? What kinds of things will you participate in or not participate in? What business practices will you do that are just and not taking advantage of others? And even if it costs some of your profits, like all those things that, as people who are participating in the world, look at what's going on. At least some people who are disillusioned will say, I think I'd like to be part of that. Not everyone will want to do that, but some will. And it just continues that sort of remnant witness to the kingdom of God in the world.
Well, I like your answer because it's not move away into the desert to become this, monastic community. But you're saying the practices, the Christian practices of worship, being in community, life groups, apprentice groups, being in the Word in the morning, prayer, these are ways of retreating to be reminded of who Christ is and then entering the world to be salt. Yeah. I love that.
And I think we could, and even more these days, if you're in a work, or you have a group of people that are maybe in different workplaces in the same field, and you gather together on Zoom at lunchtime or one evening a month, and you just talk about this unique challenges of what it means to be a faithful presence in your line of work, in the arts or in business or in education or whatever, and you wrestle with some of those tensions that you're living. Like, we don't do enough of that, I think. We have our life groups, we have our worship services, but to have groups that are really thinking, how will we be a faithful presence in our field, our line of work? Or the few Christians in a family that get together and just say, what does it mean for us to be the Christians here in a way that our family will feel us as a blessing?
Yeah.
As the beautiful love of God amongst them, even if they can't put a word to it. And that's why I love that image in Acts 27. You know, that Paul never even says, okay, guys, I want you all to become Christians, but in the midst of the storm, he takes bread, gives thanks, breaks it, and gives it to them in the code words of the Lord's Supper, and they may not catch on, but Jesus is here, and he's just being that blessing in the midst of them to strengthen them for the trial that they're going through.
That's great. Well, Tim, why don't you take it home? Like, what's a final encouragement for us as we think about living as a faithful presence this week? Somebody right now is listening to this podcast. They're on a walk. Maybe they're riding their bike. what do you want to say to them just to encourage them?
I'd probably go back to what Corey said, which is just, the heart of this is that we root ourselves in a deep confidence in the love of God for us. Mm-hmm. Dallas Willard is known for saying that we live in a perfectly safe world, which is so countercultural and doesn't sound right. But what he means is he means Romans 8, 38 and 39, right? There is nothing ever of any kind that could ever separate us from the love of God. So we're secure. What could harm us? And so because of that, we can just walk in steady faithfulness, plant our feet on the deck of the ship and say, folks are going to be okay. And call people into the presence of Jesus. And that will, like yeast, like salt, like that mustard seed, make its way into the world in such a way that people from all kinds of places will be able to find a home. So
that's good.
That's great. Yeah. Cool. I think this has been really good, guys.
And well, it means my evening rant on Facebook I'm not going to be able to do after this podcast.
Yeah, sorry, man. I know we've all been kind of watching that and really enjoying it.
But yeah.
I think, it's probably better that you don't. Yeah, you said some pretty weird stuff in the last one.
Yeah.
People are going to be like, get on Facebook right away. Where did Matthew Price say? We're just kidding. Matthew Price does not rant on Facebook, nor does Tim McCarthy.
No.
I preach sometimes, once in a while.
That's right. He gets on a little box
once
and holds his big sign up.
I want to say.
That's right. No, you don't.
But can I take this moment to say to all of our listeners, feel free to head to Tim McCarthy or Corey Alstad, whatever's, and get some of their music.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. Tim McCarthy or Alstad music, not Corey Alstad. There's a difference.
Okay. I'm a super fan of Corey on Spotify.
You literally are. I know. I literally am. Tim is. Mm-hmm. I get so excited when I see that.
I don't know if Corey's a super fan of Tim yet, but
I'm waiting. I'm working my way. It's like it's fermenting.
How do you become a super fan?
if you listen to the person's music a lot. Yeah. If you streamed his or her music a lot, then Spotify tells you, hey, you listen this many times to this person. So mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tim has listened to my music 650,000 times or so. Just kidding.
I'm the only super fan.
He's the only super fan. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, yeah.
I'm working on my album.
Really?
Are you?
That's awesome.
What is it going to be called?
Bluegrass.
Bluegrass. Yeah. No, I'm still working on the title, but just wanted everyone listening just to be aware.
People are going to be like, I remember at MSB when Matthew sang, he was so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, sang the, anyways, yeah.
No, sure. I'm not working
on
an album.
Yes, definitely. Go and listen to Tim's EP. Absolutely. Yeah, it's great.
It is good.
Thanks, guys. I think we're good. This is awesome. Yeah, this is super. Again, I know I feel like timely is the word of the month, but it feels so timely right now. So
yeah.
Thank you, Tim. It's awesome to have you here.
Shalom.
Shalom. Yeah. Guys, God bless you, North Langley. Have an awesome rest of your week.
Yeah, we love you. Bye-bye.